We saw the tabernacle was erected. All the instruction was given concerning the sacrifices. The priests were ordained and installed into office, and worship began. But no sooner than that happens, we have a fall of man. The garden, as we've seen, the tabernacle is like a new Garden of Eden. It faces eastward. It has cherubim embroidered on the veil guarding the way into the most holy place, etc. So we got a new Garden of Eden. And we have like a new Adam in Aaron and his sons, you know, who have access, you know, to the sanctuary. And so as we might expect, we have a fall in the garden once again. And when by the time then we come, you know, to chapter 10, now this new dwelling place for God has been defiled. There are corpses, you know, in the sanctuary. So how do we cleanse the tabernacle now and reconstitute it? That becomes the issue. Under what conditions may someone approach a holy God? What sort of things would exclude someone from drawing near, and so on? And that's what prompts the legislation of chapters 11 to 15, which sets forth all the distinctions between clean and unclean. All right? Now, obviously, I think God would have given, you know, would have, in the course of time, and, you know, perhaps the next day, who knows what, he would have given this instruction, but the death of Nadab and Abihu causes this instruction to be urgent. And it's very clear that references to their deaths bracket this whole section. So, for example, when you come to chapter 16, which speaks of the Day of Atonement, it says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses," and then from there he gives the instruction on the Day of Atonement. So it harkens right back to the death of Nadab and Abihu recorded in chapter 10. All right. So this legislation that comes in between here then is all intended to remedy this circumstance that has been brought about because of the death of Nadab and Abihu in, you know, within the realm of the tabernacle. And what we find in this legislation, if you remember when we spoke last time, I try to just to begin orienting us to this legislation, and I just want to remind you, if you read Leviticus 11 to 15, sounds like a whole lot of stuff here, a whole lot of rules to keep in mind. It seems like it would be, you know, terribly burdensome to try to remember all this stuff. But if you think about it, if you were brought up with this and it was part of your culture, it wouldn't have been that difficult. I liken it to, you know, when you first are learning to drive, you know, you got this booklet and you read and you're, you know, there's all these rules and, you know, you've been riding along with mom and dad all these years, but you really never paid attention. Okay, this is a solid line and this is a dotted line. And what happens if there are two solid lines and, you know, you can't pass, etc. And when you come to a four-way stop, you know, who goes first? I don't think anybody ever reads that section, but anyway, you know, the person in your right, you know, that's not supposed to happen. You're supposed to go around in a circle that way. But there's all these rules, and when, you know, you're starting the car, and this was, you know, a whole lot worse back when you had, you know, stick shift and the clutch and, you know, all that sort of stuff that you had to think about. But, you know, you're putting the car in drive and you're trying to keep it between the lines and you're looking at your speed and trying to remember the turn signals and all that. It sounds like a lot of stuff when you're starting out. The time comes when all that stuff just becomes internalized and it becomes, instinctive. That's the way this legislation would have been. It would have been, instinctive. If it was part of your culture, you did it all the time, it really wouldn't have been that big a deal. A lot of these foods, you wouldn't have been tempted to eat. Just like there are a lot of foods in our culture that we're not tempted to eat that are fine for other people in other cultures. Okay? And also, just to remember, most of the time, being unclean was no big deal. With most minor impurities, you would go about your daily life and live it normally. All that meant was you could not go to the tabernacle. With most impurities, you would be cleansed at sundown with the evening sacrifices. So unless you were on your way to the tabernacle, most time being unclean would not have been a big issue. Now, if it was some sort of lengthy, you know, like the woman with the issue of blood, we read about it in the Gospels for 12 years. I mean, you couldn't go to the annual festivals and all that. If it was a major impurity, and it would lasted a long time, that could be a big deal. But with most of the minor impurities, it just meant you couldn't go to the tabernacle that day. All right. So it sounds like a lot, but just keep that in mind. All right. Now, besides that, what we need to see is that when it comes to the clean, unclean legislation, is that these refer to ritual states. And they're basically three ritual states. There's two states, and then there's a subcategory within the other.
So I have up here, you have the state of holiness and
profane, you know, sounds like profanity, and, you know, it sounds really bad for us. It just means before the temple. So I call it holy and common. All right? So you have two ritual states, and then within the realm of the common, there's subdivisions of clean and unclean. So you could say there are then three ritual states that a person could be in ancient Israel. The ordinary status of an Israelite was clean, okay? Ceremonially clean, or we might say ceremonially pure. If they were like Aaron's sons or something, and they were sanctified, then they became holy. Now, there was a sense, you know, that all of Israel was holy in comparison to the Gentiles. They were the holy nation, the royal priesthood. But there were degrees of holiness. And so within Israel, the average Israelite was just clean. And if you were sanctified through sacrifice, through ordination, cleansing, etc., then you became holy, which means dedicated to the Lord. All right? But ordinarily, so there was a process of sanctification that made you holy. And of course, we saw with the trespass or reparation offering that you could be desanctified. You could, if you contracted holiness and you weren't supposed to, then you could be reverted back to the realm of the common. Okay? Now, your ordinary status, though, is clean, but if you contract some sort of uncleanness, then you become defiled. You need to be cleansed to become clean and therefore to have access to God again. Okay? Now, next, we have to understand being unclean had ordinarily nothing to do with sin. Now, maybe you violated the law and you became unclean, but there are certain things that would simply make you unclean for which no guilt was involved. So don't confuse uncleanness with sinfulness. You might be a godly person and be ceremonially unclean. By contrast, you could be a priest holy to the Lord and you might really be a scoundrel. See, we think about a person's a holy person, they're a godly person. Alright? But when it comes to these ritual states, those categories don't exactly, always correspond. Now, it is important to note that on the Day of Atonement, both iniquity and impurity were removed. Okay, so the Day of Atonement dealt with both. It dealt with sin and it dealt with impurity. And both were things that were to be removed. But, and I've got the little part here in quotes, sin is rooted in moral wrong. Impurity is not. What is more, sin is an action. Impurity is a state of being. Alright? What do we mean, a state of being? Clean, unclean, holy refers to the status of a person, a place, an object, or even a time. Okay? There are holy times. There are sacred times. There are days that are separate and distinct from other days that, must be kept distinct. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. Right? Okay? So, there are objects within the tabernacle that are holy to the Lord. There are vessels and so forth that are holy to the Lord. And so persons can be holy to the Lord. The high priest, has on his hat there, holy to the Lord and all that. And so likewise, then clean and unclean refers to the condition of a person, places or objects. I don't think it ever refers to time. But it can refer to persons, places, and objects. And it's essentially what they do. They simply determine where you can go and what you can do. Okay? If you are clean, you can go to the tabernacle. You can offer up sacrifices. If you are unclean, you may not. If you're clean, you can go in the courtyard. You cannot go into the holy place. You got to be holy to go in the holy place. Alright? So, whether you're holy, whether you're clean, whether you're unclean, it just refers to where you can go and what you can do. If you're unclean, some serious form of uncleanness like leprosy, which is not at all like what today is called leprosy, Hansen's disease. This is a skin disease, turns your flesh white. It infects garments, it infects houses. So don't associate it with, you see these awful pictures of people in terrible condition. It's not the same thing. Biblical leprosy is not that. All right? If you're leprous, then you might have to go out and live outside the camp, but you could live with your family and all that. Okay? I got a quote here by Jay Sklar. I was a little hesitant to share this because I don't want you to think clean means healthy, unclean means unhealthy. I don't want us to give a hygienic interpretation to this stuff because a lot of times people have come up with some really far out weird things. Well, there's hygienic reasons for all this stuff and we ought to let it direct our diets and stuff. I mean, this is where Kellogg's Corn Flakes comes from. That John Harvey Kellogg was a Seventh-day Adventist who developed Corn Flakes as a meatless breakfast food in order to curb sexual appetite. And, you eat cornflakes, it'll help reduce the libido. And, same thing with Sylvester Graham and Graham flour, which became Graham crackers. Charles Finney at Oberlin College, they used to feed their kids Graham flour all the time, to kind of keep them in check. And even today, if you go to Joseph Beth, you look in the bookstore, they'll have things in the Christian section on the Daniel diet. Daniel didn't abstain from the king's food and stuff. And you find that from time to time in aspects of the church. And all of this stuff is symbolic and it's sacramental. Okay? So I'm hesitant, but this quote that I have under letter D really does a good job, though, as long as we make that clear, of kind of explaining this clean, unclean analogy stuff. Let me read it. A modern analogy is that of physical health and cleanness. A person with the flu may not go into a hospital to hold a newborn baby, while a person who is healthy may. A person who is healthy and sterilized may go into an operating room, but a person who is simply healthy may not. Just as your physical health and cleanness determine what you can do and where you can go in a hospital, the Israelites' ritual state determined what they could do and where they could go in terms of ritual actions, places, and times. Okay? So you're healthy, you can hold a newborn baby. If you got the flu, you can't do it. But being just healthy is not enough to allow you into the operating room. You know, that's like the most holy place. All right? And so there's a correspondence there. All right? It's all about where you can go and what you can do. All right? And the important thing to point out, it all has to do with what are the prerequisites for drawing near to the Lord. Nadab and Abihu just drew near to the Lord. They offered profane fire. Profane, or, you know, the opposite of holy. And God struck them dead for what they did. And so if you're unclean and you go into the divine presence, or you're just clean and you're not holy and you try to draw too near. Remember we said Nadab and Abihu very, very possibly tried to go past the veil from the hints, you know, were given. You do that, you risk immediate death. And not only that, if that tabernacle now is not cleansed because it's become defiled, God may pack up and leave. And that's the greatest threat. And before the Babylonian captivity, Ezekiel sees the glory cloud lift up and leave the temple and go to the Mount of Olives. So likewise, when you come to the Gospels, what happens? Jesus, he walks out of the temple for the last time. He goes to the Mount of Olives. He says, see this temple? It's going to be destroyed. All right? And so you don't want that. All right? Ken, yes, sir. You know, Uzzah, clearly he's not, you know, he's not holy. The thing is that Nadab and Abihu are holy, but they're not most holy. We don't know exactly what they did. There's some indication they may have been drunk, but because it says they offered strange fire, they wonder if they did not try to go behind the veil because censers was part of the Day of Atonement, right? You came in there, you filled up the room with smoke, with cloud. And so why is that what happened? We don't know.
But the reason I'm asking, it seems like they never carried the ark in full.
They were supposed to, and that's the big problem. They had it on the cart. And those of you said, they didn't obey the law to start with when you're transporting.
But they were like a very, very close proximity. It wasn't until they actually touched it.
Yeah. Well, holy and unclean cannot come in contact. Absolutely not. They cannot. Usually what would happen, though, the unclean defiles the holy. See, there's the problem. And to give the illustration, Haggai, Prophet Haggai, ministers to the people at the return from captivity. The economy's tanking. They are not building the temple. And Haggai gives them this little riddle, and he says, so if somebody's carrying, I shared this before, I think, somebody's carrying holy meat in the garment, and it comes in contact with somebody who's defiled, what happens? Okay, the garment becomes defiled, the apron becomes defiled, the meat becomes defiled. Okay, because the unclean makes that which is holy, the sacrificial meat, defiled. That's the way it worked. Okay, and so Haggai then goes on to say, that's why your economy is tanking, everything's doing bad, because you are an unholy people. You don't have your priorities right, you're not building the temple of God. And that's why the story about the woman with the issue of blood is so remarkable, because she touched Jesus' garment. His garment should have been defiled, he should have been defiled, and instead she's cleansed. But that's the new covenant. In the old covenant, the unclean things defile the things that are holy. Well, yeah, I guess if you were ceremonially, I have to look. I don't remember. If you're ceremonially clean, would that make you holy? I know if you're unclean, that which is holy is defiled in the old covenant, and that's reversed in the new. I don't remember in regard to if you're just clean. Okay, let's turn over to the second page there. So mentioned before, when it comes to uncleanness, there are minor impurities, there are major impurities. Most minor impurities were taken care of simply by cleansing or maybe laundering your garment. You might have to do that. Most of them only lasted one day. They were not contagious. So let's say you contracted some sort of minor impurity. You had sexual intercourse the night before. You're unclean until the evening, until the evening sacrifice and sundown. Okay? You do not contaminate somebody, by being unclean in that case. If you have a more major impurity, like coming in contact with a corpse, you're leprous, something like that, that may last longer, and you're going to have to go through a rite of cleansing on the third day and on the seventh day, okay? And then on the eighth day, the day of new beginning, of course, the day of circumcision, the first day of the new week, etc., the eighth day being Sunday, so to speak, then you're cleansed from the more major impurity. Okay, so there are minor impurities, there are major impurities, and we'll kind of get into those distinctions as we go. Letter H here says, it is also important to note that ritual states were not moral states. What this means is that a person in a ritual state of holiness was not necessarily more righteous than a person who was simply clean or even unclean. In fact, it is usually not wrong to become unclean in that many of the things for which a person could become unclean were proper and good. And what I have referenced there is childbirth, Leviticus 12, and then sexual intercourse with a husband and wife in Leviticus 15. Those things were not immoral, but they would render you unclean. All right? But just note that, this has nothing to do with your integrity. That's why I say, when you think about that woman with the issue of blood,
for 1,500 years, she's been taught that which is unclean is undefiled, that which is holy. The Malachi prophesies of one, the Son of Righteousness, with healing in his wings. And the word for wing is the word for corner. Each Israelite, according to Numbers 15, they had a garment, an outward robe, imagine like a square sheet or something with a hole in the middle, like a poncho. And along the bottom, there was a blue cord with four tassels, four wings, right? Because, like the cherubim are described having four wings. Seraphim got six, and cherubim. Well, the cherubim are around God's throne. Israel's around God's throne. And they have these tassels on the corners of their garments. The word for corner, the word for wing, are the same. This woman understands Jesus is the Son of Righteousness with healing in his wings. She's a person of tremendous faith. When she reached out, she touched that garment, And that's why Jesus says, "Who touched me?" And she, she's kind of cowering and stuff. But she seemed to have perceived that Jesus was the one of whom Malachi was speaking, and that now, holiness is spreading, okay, in the new covenant. So she's a godly person. Meanwhile, you got a lot of high priests and stuff that are ungodly, even though they were holy to the Lord. Okay, so don't confuse ritual and moral states. All right, what's the rationale for the clean, unclean laws? Roman numeral 2. Seth, are you wanting to sing a song or two today, I think?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, the clean, unclean distinctions are all, again, they're laid out in chapters 11 to 15. And you can just see how they're kind of laid out in an overview. You have a list of clean, unclean animals in chapter 11. You have rituals for cleansing after childbirth in chapter 12. You got skin and surface diseases, chapter 13. Skin and house diseases. Again, leprosy can infect a house. It can infect garments. And then you have bodily discharges, particularly bodily discharges, usually from private parts, for reasons we'll see. There is all sorts of, there's been a tremendous amount of work, a whole lot more needs to be done, but a lot of work has been done on what is the rationale for all this clean, unclean stuff. You know, we read, if you're reading through your Bibles and, you know, you set a goal to read through the Bible and you get to all this stuff and it just, you get bogged down in it and you read this, these chapters and, you know, to help you in your devotional life and walk with the Lord, and you're reading this stuff and you don't feel like you're getting a whole lot out of it. I mean, there's a reason why everybody wants to preach through Romans and ignore Leviticus, right? So what's all this stuff about? Well, there's been a tremendous amount of work done on it, and scholars aren't all in agreement. In general, there's some agreement, but when you get to a lot of the particulars, there's not. But most believe that the contrast here is between life and death. And the clean, unclean distinctions mark out the two spatially. All right? The Lord is the giver of life. He's the source of life. To live in God's presence eternally is life in abundance. Right? And conversely, to be removed from God's presence, to be cast out of the garden, to be cast out into the wilderness, you know, where the scapegoat goes on the Day of Atonement, is to be driven farthest away from God. And that's, you know, there's the place of death. So these distinctions have to do with nearness of, have to do spatially with nearness to the Lord's presence. The nearer you are, you know, to God, the nearer you are to life. And so a state of cleanness always is reflective some way of life. And uncleanness is associated in one form or another with death. The farther you are away from God, the closer you are from death. So the things associated with uncleanness are things that are associated with death. The things associated with cleanness are things associated with life. Letter C here says in Roman number 2, C, while contracting uncleanness was a movement towards from life towards death, the purification rituals were understood as a movement from death towards life, typically involving symbols of life, things like blood and water. You know, life is in the blood. Water cleanses. Jesus says, you know, out of his stomach will flow, you know, rivers of living water. In the Bible, especially in agricultural community, you know, if it doesn't rain, what's going to happen to the crops, right? That's why Baal was the storm god. That's why Israelites, the big threat when they entered into the Canaan was, you know, worshiping Baal so he would make it rain. That's why the nature of the contest between Elijah and the prophets of Baal was what it was. Who can make it rain? We'll see who really who's really the storm god. Alright? And of course in Revelation 22, there's a river flowing out of the New Jerusalem and trees grow up on both sides and the leaves are for the healing of the nations and all that. And you know, Psalm 1, the righteous is like the tree planted by the rivers of waters. You know, look at your lawns right now, how green they are in August. Isn't this a, you know, kind of a strange circumstance? That seems to be the idea. Okay? And if you think about it in that term, suddenly certain things seem to start making sense that otherwise wouldn't. Okay? Letter D here, let me just, it says, Gordon Wenham explains that while childbirth, menstruation, and sexual intercourse were normal activities, they still caused uncleanness because each involved the loss of life liquids, so to speak, which barred people from worship until they recovered from such loss. God, who is perfect life and perfect holiness, can only be approached by clean men who enjoy fullness of life themselves. The unclean are those who in some way have an aura of death about them in that they manifest less than physical wholeness. Okay? What do we mean by this?
Why would childbirth, which is a good thing, why would that make you ceremonially unclean? Okay? God said, be fruitful and multiply. That was before the fall. That's good. Well, it has to do with the loss of blood, particularly in the private parts. Because seriously, if you cut your arm and you bled, you did not become unclean by that. It's blood or it's semen, intercourse, you know, which is blessed by God with a husband and wife. That made you unclean until sundown. All right? So those things would render you unclean. But just cutting your arm and bloodletting, that would not render you unclean. Similarly, urination would not make you unclean. I know I'm talking about some sensitive stuff here. I'm not nearly as bad as what, you know, what's coming, right? Okay? So, I mean, this gets into some weird stuff. That's why people don't preach on, you know, on issues. People have issues, but this is all about bodily issues, okay? Lots of that kind of crazy stuff here in Leviticus. So, that seems to explain why certain things, you know, depending on where a liquid is flowing out of your body, that determines whether it produces cleanness or uncleanness and what kind of fluid it is. Okay? Seems to have to do with life and death, more specifically. And Jordan has convinced me of this, and I wish more people were aware of him or were interacting with his work. But I think he's done a better job than because he's studied Leviticus for, I don't know, four decades now or whatever. But I think he's shown that all of the forms of uncleanness are some way associated with the curse placed upon Adam and Eve after the fall. What we mean by that is we will see when you look at the unclean animals. The uncleanness usually has to do with how they come in contact with the soil. How they come in contact with the ground. The type of shoes they have, whether they have cloven hooves, or whether they crawl in the dust, right? Because dust thou art, dust you shall return. And what's the curse on the serpent? He's going to crawl in the dust. And so that's why when you come into God's presence in Scripture, you know, it's you're on holy ground, you take your shoes off. Right? And that's why, you know, if a town is cursed, you shake the dust off your feet, right? You shake the curse off your feet. That's part of the judgment that God imposed upon people. Okay? Childbirth. Why would childbirth, something good and blessed of God, contract uncleanness? Why would that do it? Well, it has to do with, you know, the curse pronounced on Eve. And then, you know, the day you eat of the fruit, you're going to die. You're going to see leprosy in the Bible is associated with death. Your skin turns white. Just like, you know, if I shoot you, you bleed out. What happens? You know, you turn a whiter shade of pale, so to speak. All those things are associated some way with the curse. When you start really looking at the particulars and you look at, okay, so why does this make you unclean, but that doesn't make you unclean? And there seems to be a whole lot of logic to all of these things are some way associated with the curse. Okay? That it is placed on man and that excluded man from the presence of God.
And that explains why, you know, the garments, why the high priest has to put on linen garments, you know, because God doesn't want to see sweat. So he has to take off his wool. He has to put on his linen garments. And that's why, you know, we've talked before that Jesus, the Spirit takes the time to tell us that, you know, they saw Jesus' linen garments in the tomb. Jesus is the high priest. I totally missed this when we talked about the ordination of the priest. This is a little side, a little rabbit trail. Remember, we said that the blood was placed on the right ear, the right thumb, the right big toe of the priest. And that was like called the circumcision of the ear. And like so, according to the law, if you wanted to become a servant to your master, you went to the doorpost of the house and you had your right ear pierced on the doorpost, so the blood was put on the doorpost, and you became servant to some master. Well, think about the night in which Jesus is betrayed. They come to bind Jesus, who is the sacrifice, and Malchus, Peter reaches out, and Peter takes his sword and he cuts off the, which ear? Just an ear? What? The right ear of Malchus. Why are we told that? Why does the Spirit, why is the left ear never mentioned? Okay? His ear was being circumcised, or in this case, castrated. Jesus, you know, he's not hearing his true master's voice. And Jesus puts it back on. Israel's going to get another chance, you know. But I think that's clearly why are we told this man's name in all four Gospels? And why are we told it's specifically the right ear? All this stuff's pointing forward to Jesus. It's all symbolic. It's all sacramental and all that. And I think all of this clean, unclean stuff is symbolic. It's sacramental. And it's pointing back to the curse. Any questions or comments right there? Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
John records Jesus cleansing the temple early in his ministry. The synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, they all recorded him cleansing the temple at the end of his ministry. Okay? So it's clearly there's two cleansings. Jesus cleanses at the beginning of his ministry, and yet the fact that he had to do it again shows that it is still defiled. And let's see, what was I going to say? When Jesus talked about you clean a house, and then you know of these demons, and then they come back with more, you know, and that's really what has happened. Jesus gave Israel an opportunity to repent. He cleansed the temple. Israel continued in its sin. Israel's going to crucify their Messiah. Jesus cleanses it the second time. He walks out, says this is going to be destroyed. I mean, it's pretty clear it's a leprous house. And that's why, you know, when you read the Gospels, I always tell them, Jesus heals the lame, he heals the deaf, he heals the blind, he cleanses lepers. That's a different word. He always cleanses lepers. He doesn't heal them, he cleanses them. Just like he cleanses the temple. It's like, I don't know if I'm... Okay, we're going to look at that. We will look at that. Yeah.
So with the animals that are unclean, because of their contact with the earth.
Yeah, or you know, like what they eat, things like that.
And then, because also in the chapter where he talks about fish, the scales, fins, and then, you know.
It's like, it's as if they have armor. We're going to get into it. The ones that, you know, have scales, like have armor, you know, from the environment, and those who don't. We'll get into that. We'll try to make sense of it anyway. But it does seem to have to do with contact with the environment.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, a couple of questions that maybe are related to others. You know, obviously, I'm sure it would be convenient for people to be done. You know, it's kind of like you're doing the angles and set the top, and now I can't go do X, Y, and Z ritually. Are there any examples in scripture of people showing emotion or disappointment?
Next question.
Just thinking about I just wonder if it was so ingrained in the Israel's understanding of the symbolic nature of these things that they understood that this was, you know, because uncleanness and cleanness of the product. So if it was just so ingrained in their understanding of their these things pointing to the truth of life and death and God, basically, if they just sort of went about their days, they think, "Oh well, you know, this just happens." Since God's dedication says that it is still.
Yeah. Let me say that. Okay. So the question was, you know, how much did they understand about this? Did they see how this was pointing them to, you know, to Christ and all that sort of stuff? Or did they just, God says to do this and let's do it? It's hard to say, and scholars debate, how much did they understand? You know, part of, and remember, God is, Israel under the law is a child under a tutor, under a guardian. And when you're a child, you're just supposed to, a lot of times you just do what parents tell you to do because that's what you're supposed to do. You don't understand the rationale for it. I do, you don't. You just do this, okay? And so it's possible to some extent that they just, you know, this is what we're supposed to do. And then again, it's possible that they understood a lot more of this than we do because they thought symbolically. Sometimes there are rituals that you do and we don't even know the reasons for it. Like today we're told, okay, so look at Ben here. He's got his hat right here. Now why does Ben take this off when he's inside? Because we know this is what you're supposed to do inside. Why? What's the rationale? What is the rationale? We all know you're supposed to take your hat off inside. But what is the rationale? I'm sure a long time ago there was probably some reason why you did that. You know, it's like, you know, a salute. You raised up the visor on you're a knight and you raise it up to show who it is, because it's like wearing a burqa. I don't know what's behind there, you know, so I'm going to show you I'm not your enemy. You can see me. And so now we do this, you know, so. Where does that come from? So there's debate on this. How much did they know? I think they knew more than we know, but did they understand all this stuff? They know. But that's, there are times where something happens where Jacob wrestles with his angel and he's got, you know, this hip out of joint. And so after that, the Israelites, they don't eat the right thigh. Why? I have no idea, but apparently they thought they shouldn't do it. And there's probably something going on there that we don't get. Okay? Roman numeral 3, last page, real fast. I hope that answers things somewhat. Let me just mention, I want to make it real clear that there doesn't appear to be any health or hygienic reasons behind the clean uncleanness legislation. These, if you look at them more closely, they are symbolic and sacramental. Paul says, 1 Timothy 4, you know, nothing's to be refused if we give thanks. If you want to eat possum, if you want to eat roadkill in the New Covenant, you are free to do so. Okay? As long as you give thanks, God, good gift. All right? And I say that because there has been that tendency, like I mentioned, with Kellogg's cornflakes, with graham crackers, etc., in the history of the church, from time to time, to people say, well, there's hygienic reasons behind this. Well, you know, washing yourself probably would have been, you know, good. I mean, that's fine. But it doesn't seem to be the rationale behind this. And just, I'll give a few illustrations here. An animal died by itself. Okay, it's one thing if you killed, it's another thing if the animal died by itself. Like I said, if it's roadkill, I made this mistake of watching that movie, The Revenant, with Leo DiCaprio. It was shot in Alberta, Canada, you know, where we were here a month ago. And that is a harsh movie. It's, you know, back these fur traders. And Lisa was watching it with me, and she was just on her phone the whole time. I can't watch it. I mean, it's grizzly bear mauls him, and then, you know, he cuts this horse open and crawls inside of it, you know, to stay warm at night. So, I mean, he's eating a liver and all this. And apparently Lisa read the trivia on it that Leonardo DiCaprio was a vegetarian. And the liver stuff that they had, the fake didn't look real enough. And so for authenticity, he ate it. And he said he'll never do that again. And anyway, where am I going with this? I don't know. I don't even know. I've lost it now, but you can, there's been all sorts of talk about, you know, why you eat this and why you can't eat that. And some people have tried to make health or hygienic applications to this. And like I said, you can eat whatever unclean thing you want to eat. You can do it. All right. Peter in Acts chapter 10 has this vision. And he sees that these unclean foods, and God tells him to eat them. And he's like, I've never done that. And God says, don't call unclean what I've made clean. Okay. And then Peter explains that about the gospel going to the Gentiles. All that clean, unclean distinction has symbolic reasons, believers, unbelievers, etc. Okay, so if you look at the law, you can see this all come out. If a person ate an animal died by itself, this is where I came, you know, he became unclean. If it died by itself, right? So he becomes unclean. Well, he's cleaned by washing himself, washing his garments, and waiting till sundown. How does would washing your garments heal a disease from eating an animal which you have, you know, ingested? How would waiting to sundown have any impact on that? Okay. So you've washed yourself, you've washed your garments, but you're still unclean to sundown. How does sundown cleanse a disease? I asked the question, is there some health or hygienic benefit from wearing clothes made of mixed fibers? This is suffering and sickness of today caused by our mixed cotton and polyester blends. Does anyone today actually keep these laws? Okay, and obviously those are rhetorical questions, all right? But you do see sometimes in Christian literature, the Bill Gothard Institute kind of promotes some of this stuff. They have before. Rush Dooney debated, you know, whether we, you know, ought to keep some of these things for a time. It just doesn't seem to make, you know, to make any sense. And like I said, when it comes to, some people say, well, I'm not going to eat this or that, but, you know, they still wear mixed garments and so forth. And so I just want a little clarification. This stuff is all symbolic and sacramental. Okay? There doesn't appear to be any health or hygienic reasons behind it. Okay?
But it's symbolic.
It's symbolic. That's what we're going to see. You got to come back next week, Dan.